or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Liberals, progressives, and conservatives alike are well aware that the declining unemployment rate is not really quite of a fair metric of what's really going on in people's lives. It masks people's struggles to find good, decent-paying, stable employment, at least if you're outside the tech industry. If you're in tech, I guess it's not so bad. The labor participation rate, that is the percentage of people ages 16 to 64 who are employed or actively looking for work, is down to 62.8%. That's within one-tenth of 1% of the lowest since early 1978. The median household income in inflation-adjusted dollars is at its lowest since 1995. Can there ever be enough jobs for America's 200-plus million people of working age, half of whom have an IQ of under 100, people who by definition are below average in cognitive ability and reasoning skills, especially in an information-based, tech-centric global economy? What to do? In the just-completed election cycle, we've heard lots of bumper sticker rhetoric, but with too few specifics. And indeed, the devil is in the details. It's not enough for progressives to say, build infrastructure and raise the minimum wage. And it's not enough for conservatives and libertarians to say, cut taxes and let the free market do its thing, the invisible hand. There really are pros, cons, and trade-offs to all solutions. If it were easy and clear, a U.S. jobs creation policy would have been enacted long ago. And none of those kind of solutions are truly bold enough to deal with the aforementioned massive problem. With employers mandated to provide ever more benefits and legal protections to workers at the same time as ever more work can be automated or offshored, and ever more full-time benefited positions are converted to just-in-time, part-time, temp, hourly gigs, and America's aforementioned 200 million people of working age, half, by definition, are below average in cognitive and reasoning skills, in that information-based, tech-centric global economy, what's going to happen? Even at the top end, major national publications are asking writers to write for free for the privilege of saying they write for a national publication. Even some medical schools are asking some faculty to teach classes to future MDs for free. In an attempt to provide better answers and more light than heat, I've invited not politicians, but two thoughtful experts, one whom I know quite well, who's been on the show twice, and now is his third time, who's great, to debate this question. Is a liberal / progressive approach to job creation wiser, or is a conservative or libertarian approach wiser, or neither? Do we need bolder solutions than either mainstream liberal or conservative thinking is offering these days? On the left, the aforementioned Jared Bernstein. He is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden in the Obama administration. He's a frequent guest on CNN and CNBC. He's also, as I said, appeared twice on this show, most recently, to debate whether to raise the minimum wage. And he's a heck of a debater, Jared Bernstein. Pleasure to welcome you back to Work with Marty Nemko.
It's great to talk to you again, Marty. Too long.
Great. Excellent. And on the right, and I'm sorry I can't be as effusive because I just don't know you, but I'll tell you the truth. What happened is I asked Jared, I said, who is somebody who holds kind of an opposing overall worldview, who's great nonetheless, and a worthy, not somebody who's just going to bash you and stretch the truth or whatever, but a guy who's really smart, really fair-minded, on kind of, quote, an opposite side, if not the opposite side. And the first name he mentioned, and I'm delighted that he said yes, is Michael Strain. Michael Strain is a resident scholar of the American Enterprise Institute, former assistant economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. His essays and op-eds have been published in outlets ranging from the New York Times and the Atlantic on the left, lest he be seen as too much of an ideologue, to the National Review, Weekly Standard, and Forbes on the right. Michael Strain, it is indeed a genuine pleasure to have you on the program as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. Well, here's how the debate's going to work. Unlike in it, and this, by the way, dear listeners, I'm not springing this on my guests at the time. I'm more telling you this to inform you, the listeners. These guys know what's going to be happening in terms of the structure. Unlike in a traditional debate, we are not interested in a winner. We are interested in both sides' legitimate points being made, with each side acknowledging the other side's valid points. The debate will have been a success to the extent we have honestly and intelligently explored the issue of how to create jobs in full dimension. Yet it still is a debate, not just a conversation, because the clash of ideas can, as our system of jurisprudence kind of is linchpinned on, can be a very useful vehicle for teasing out the best arguments. So I'm going to ask each of you to make a 2-minute opening statement. Then you'll have a 15 to 20 minute free-form exchange, the goal of which, as I said, is to elucidate the best arguments from wherever on the political-economic spectrum they may come. Of course, feel free to challenge your opponent with data or logic, but also feel free to agree with the other person when they make a good point. As a moderator, I may redirect the conversation if it's feeling redundant or I believe an important point is not being addressed, and we will end with each of you making a 90-second closing statement, which hopefully will not just recapitulate your opening statement, but demonstrate an evolution of your argument as a result of the debate. I've simply at random asked Jared to go first in making the opening statement. Michael, you go first in your closing statement. Is that okay?
Fine.
Great. So, Jared, make the case for why a liberal or slash progressive approach to job creation is ultimately wiser.
So if you go historically all the way back to Keynes, the progressive approach to job creation was really important only in recessions. The main difference between progressives and conservatives is that liberals believed that when markets failed, government had a temporary role to play to help close the gaps in unemployment and GDP, while conservatives did not. And most economists now reject that view, and our arguments tend to be more nuanced, as I hope we'll see in our debate today. I know for a fact that Michael and I share some common ground, and I also think that in the name of reality, however, we should be careful to distinguish between the reasonable differences we may share and the unreasonable ones I hear debated on Capitol Hill.
Hmm.
On the conservative side, it's still largely a supply-side trickle-down economics, the idea that if you cut taxes for the wealthy and you cut benefits for the poor, the jobs will just come. The underlying philosophy is the reason that people don't have jobs is because they don't want them badly enough, a position that I believe is completely at odds with reality. You see this most clearly in the budgets of, say, the conservative leader, Representative Paul Ryan, who cuts about $5 trillion in spending over 10 years, with 70% of the spending cuts coming from programs that help low-income people, like food stamps and kids' health insurance and Pell Grants to help those with college costs. And those same budget cuts cut taxes by about the same amount without closing one loophole to help offset their costs, the revenue losses. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that every dollar we spend on low-income programs is effectively or efficiently utilized, and I suspect Michael and I could find some cuts to agree on. And while I support minimum wage increases in a moderate amount, as you've mentioned, they help improve the quality of low-wage jobs. I don't see that they do nearly enough for the quantity of jobs. I'll give my own ideas in a moment, but I want our listeners to be aware that the conservative approach remains, as far as I can see, stuck in this trickle-down swamp. So far, the main ideas I've heard from the victors of last Tuesday's election include cutting corporate taxes, more trade agreements, repealing Obamacare, and building out the Keystone Pipeline. I don't believe any of those will help much at all with job creation. What I do think will help are the following. We have deep infrastructure needs in this country. Our stock of public goods is obviously in ill repair. Borrowing costs are low, and these are productive investments that help both on the labor side with jobs and on the business side with more efficient access to markets. Historically, there's been bipartisan agreement there. Our manufacturers have been hurt for decades now by large and persistent trade deficits, and we could and should do something to lower them. That would definitely help create some good middle-income jobs. Apprenticeship and on-the-job training programs have helped groups with high unemployment rates get back into the job market. They should be scaled up. And finally, during the Recovery Act, we found that temporarily subsidizing the wages of highly disadvantaged workers, like some of those with long-term unemployment, was both effective and had bipartisan appeal. So I'd scale that up as well.
Thank you very much. You know, I feel a need to say this. You know, I watch so much TV, like on shows where there's these opinions, and the guests come in unprepared. Whether somebody agrees or not, I think, dear listeners, you have to thank Jared Bernstein for totally being prepared for this. That was an excellent, excellent, thoughtful opening statement.
Thank you.
Michael Strain, please, 2 minutes on why you think a conservative or libertarian-ish approach would be a wiser, ultimate approach to creating jobs in the U.S.
Well, so I'd like to agree with two things that Jared said. I think there are lots of bad ideas on Capitol Hill, and I'm happy we can come together on that, both from the left and from the right. And I think the government does have a role to step in during recessions. And I think that role manifests itself both in terms of the response of the Federal Reserve and monetary stimulus and in terms of a response from the federal government in terms of fiscal policy. I also agree that conservatives are typically more concerned about the supply side of the economy than the demand side of the economy during expansions. And I think in some ways that's appropriate. But I think in order to make the debate comprehensive, we have to distinguish between what happens in a recession and what happens in a healthy economy. So in general, I would say that there are three principles that I hold. One is that government should provide the preconditions for the private market to flourish. Two, government often needs to get out of the way because it tends to overreach. Number three, government needs to tailor its activities to help those who truly need a hand up. In doing all that, government needs to avoid falling into the law of unintended consequences, and the government needs to recognize that there are real limits to what it can do well, despite what its intentions may be. So for the first point, providing the preconditions, I think that a multi-year infrastructure program is a great idea. I think we should do it right now. It would help create jobs, but we should think of this as a 5 to 10 year thing, and we should not think of it as, you know, something that's going to happen in the next 6 months that's going to create a whole bunch of jobs within the next 9 months and you know, that doesn't fall into this whole shovel-ready trap. Trade liberalization, corporate tax reform, these are all things that have been discussed, as Jared said. They're things that I think, you know, feasibly could get done, and they're things that I think would help on the margin. Education reform is desperately needed in order to give people what they need to survive the kind of economy that you described in the introduction. But a lot of that is government kind of getting out of the way. You know, we've seen there are a whole new species of post-secondary education that are being developed, and they're running into accreditation problems and regulatory problems and things of that nature. If the government were to use its power to bust up some of those pre-existing institutions to make way for some newer innovative ideas, that could help equip people with the skills they need. Things like occupational licensing reform. Corporations spend a lot of money on regulatory compliance that could be spent instead on productive investment and training. We need longer-term entitlement reform if we're going to have jobs in the 15 to 30 year range, like we could have, and so that, you know, these are some examples of government needed to get out of the way. I also think government needs to help. One supply side innovation that I think Jared and I will agree on is an EITC expansion. By increasing the rewards to work, the EITC will draw people.
The earned income tax credit. Continue.
The earned income tax credit, precisely, will draw people into the labor force who otherwise wouldn't be there. That, I think, is a great role for government. Another important role for government is to improve transportation networks for low-income workers by reducing their commute times. That's going to provide an incentive for some folks on the margin to enter the labor force who otherwise wouldn't. So those are examples of proactive things that government should do to help low-income workers get their foot in the door in the labor market. So I think, you know, Jared and I are going to agree on a lot of those things, and I think the fact that we'll get to agreement coming from such different premises indicates that those are really good ideas. And there's some sources of disagreement as well, obviously.
Okay. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. As we semi-regularly do on the show, we have debates on the issues of the day. There's nothing more related to the fundamental basis of the show, which is about work, than what do we do about job creation. And it is a pleasure to have I deliberately like friendly debates. I think these debates between two people who are just just trying to win is not necessarily the most helpful. But I have two people who have different, come from different perspectives, but who are nonetheless civil about it and much more interested in finding both common ground where it exists as well as expressing their differences. I think that's what public radio at its best is like. So it is my pleasure to, for those of you just joining us, we're having this debate with Jared on the left, Jared Bernstein, who is the former chief economist for Vice President Joe Biden, and Michael Strain, who is a senior scholar at the resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. So now, as promised, we're going to take 15 minutes or so, roughly, for you guys, without me trying to stay out of the way. I'd love to be able to not say a word. If you guys can just have kind of a free-form conversation debate about either specific issues that particularly titillated you, maybe you've focused a lot on your areas of commonality, maybe teasing out some of your areas of difference, have a free-form conversation that's going to try to bring more light to this whole question. I'll try to stay out of it, and just the only thing I will advise is try to keep it brief, because if it's a series of lecturettes, try to keep it like it's a conversation, you're having a beer with each other, and you're each talking 15, 30 seconds, and he may interrupt, and you just kind of go back and forth like a ping-pong game for 15 minutes. Ideally, I would just shut up. So whoever wants to start, please feel free to do it.
Well, this is Jared. I'll jump in. Yeah, I think there are both agreements and differences that we could try to tease out. First of all, on some of the things that we agree on, Michael, and there's been other conservatives who have suggested that expanding the earned income tax credit would be a smart thing to do, especially for childless adults. They tend to get very little, just a few hundred bucks a year, from this very important wage subsidy for low-income workers, whereas if you've got a few kids, your EITC benefits can be in the thousands of dollars. However, both that, his transportation ideas, which I like, and the infrastructure ideas, which I particularly like, the long-term planning is smart, they require spending. And one of the problems that I see from the conservative side is that people like Michael come up with good ideas that we agree on, and they're completely dead on arrival on Capitol Hill, because the conservative bloc absolutely refuses to spend a dime on anything. And that is, I should say, in terms of new spending, and that's largely driven by an absolute refusal to raise any new revenue. So I'd love Michael to tangle with that a bit. And then the only
Let's take that one at a time. Why don't you go ahead, Michael?
So I'm happy to. So I agree that conservatives are relatively more concerned about spending than liberals, and certainly I am concerned about the amount of money that we spend today. But more so, I'm concerned about the amount of money we're projected to spend in the future as medical costs increase and the baby boom moves further into retirement. So I would want to do some of these things in a way that keeps a lid on spending. And the way that I would propose, and that I have proposed, and that I think is in keeping with conservative principles, is to take some of the money that we currently spend on rich people and instead spend it on low-income Americans for things like the EITC expansion, like transportation networks, and like infrastructure. Infrastructure will benefit everybody, but the first two are targeted very well toward low-income people. So what is some of that spending? We spend a lot of money on folks in the top 20% through the mortgage interest deduction. That right there, if we just got rid of that, would be tens of billions of dollars a year that we could direct toward these low-income folks who need help. The state and local tax deduction, another source of spending through the tax code, that offers a great resource to redirect some of that money from the rich to the poor. So I think conservatives shouldn't like government spending a lot of money on rich people. And conservatives should, I think, support helping low-income people. And there's all this money that we could redirect without increasing the overall amount of money the government spends.
So let me jump in on that. I agree very much. But I must say again, and I just need to stress this to kind of try to keep it real, that Michael probably knows the conservative bloc better than I do. But those ideas have been on the table for years and have been roundly rejected by conservative policymakers. And in fact, I'll suggest one. I'd really be interested in if Michael likes this idea. It's actually very hard to go through the list of all those tax expenditures, many of which are upside down, just like Michael said. They help folks who actually don't really need the help, and pick out the ones you'd like to get rid of and the others you'd like to keep. President Obama, since the days when I was there, back in 2009, has had in his budget a very smart idea in this regard, which is that only allow the wealthiest taxpayers to take their tax exemptions not at their top rate, not at 35 or 40%, but at 28%. So in other words, it doesn't try to cherry-pick which tax expenditure should go. It says that they can only deduct 28 cents on the dollar instead of 40 cents on the dollar. And let me tell you, that raises $500 billion over 10 years. So it'd be great if Michael would join me on that idea.
Yeah, so I will agree with Jared that a lot of these ideas have run into opposition from some of the more libertarian elements of Congress. And, you know, I think that's something that many people on the right are trying to you know push against a little bit and suggest that some of the Republicans in Congress need to have a more proactive agenda other than simply an agenda that consists of cutting spending and cutting taxes and obstructing. So I wouldn't want to suggest to your listeners that some of the ideas that I just threw out have broad-based support among the Tea Party or anything. They don't, but that's something that I'm trying to change, and that many others in the conservative movement and the conservative side of things are trying to change.
You know what? Before you go on, I want to actually, because they're right now, I'm hearing two arguments from the middle right to the left, and I want to at least before we just wave with a magic hand with a broad brush hand that conservative argument. Let me lay out that conservative argument from the libertarian angle, and I'd like you both to respond. So they would say we already have this massive deficit, we have this massive budget. There is tremendous freight, waste, fraud, and abuse, and programs that have been demonstrated not to work that continue to be funded massively, even Head Start, where the data, even from the Obama administration, says doesn't work. So damn it, let's cut some of those programs rather than raise more revenue, because the dollar is left better in the hands of a citizen and potentially a job creator than on all that fraud, waste, and abuse. What would be your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I think there's one factual mistake in that rap, which has to do with the magnitude of our budget deficits. If I were talking to you 3 or 4 years ago when the budget deficit was about 10% of GDP, I'd say, yes, we have a large budget deficit. I'd also say we'd need one because we had to offset the private sector contraction of the Great Recession. Right now, our budget deficit is below 3% of GDP. It's the lowest it's been in years, and the decline over the past 5 years is the largest decline in the budget deficit since the 1950s. So I think we need to be clear at the actual numbers in that regard. In terms of wasteful spending, look, I mean, Michael and I just identified a bunch of it that's targeted at the upper end. I'm sure you could find some targeted at the lower end, and I believe there are. I know, Marty, you know this literature. I believe there are inefficient programs for training and for kids' education. Mm-hmm. My understanding of Head Start is that it's spotty. You can actually find Head Start programs that have a very good track record. But that's, if you actually look at the amount of dollars that we spend on that, I'm not saying we could waste any one of them. It's tiny compared to these tax expenditures that Michael and I were just talking about.
Michael?
So you know, I think I obviously agree with Jared about the deficit, and you know, I think it's, you know, it's just a matter of fact that the deficit is dramatically smaller than it was. And you know, I think that I'm probably more sympathetic to the libertarian critique than Jared is, because I do think that there's a lot of stuff that the government does poorly, and a lot of perhaps more importantly, there are a lot of things the government does that end up causing unintended consequences and causing some real damage. So, you know, some programs like Social Security disability insurance, I think you can make a pretty strong argument that there are a lot of people in that program who are kind of trapped and who would be better off if they weren't in the program. At the state and local level, occupational licenses are really a serious problem, and that's a classic example of government protecting and using its regulatory power to protect incumbents and to put its foot on the back of new entrants into markets. Businesses have a lot of money set aside for regulatory compliance that they could be putting into private investment and more productive uses. I think Jared and I disagree about the Affordable Care Act, the implicit tax rates that are imposed by the phase out of subsidies provide a work disincentive that I think is destructive. And I think if the requirements of the ACA were less, the subsidies could be cheaper and the phase outs could be less problematic.
Let me respond. I mean, I think that a lot of what you're saying, Michael, is either correct or stuff we can argue about. We could have good arguments about the ACA. I actually think the increase in the disability rolls have a lot to do with demographics. The baby boomers moving into their high disability years, more women qualifying for disability benefits because they finally have enough labor force participation, the increase in Social Security retirement age. That explains about half of the increase in my view. But here's the thing. Here's a big difference between us, I think. Almost everything you've talked about in the recent part of the debate, whether it's regulatory compliance, the ACA, the disability rolls, occupational protectionism, which I object to as well, but by the way, it's not just at the low end, of course, it's doctors and lawyers as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of that is going to create significant magnitudes of jobs. I think some of that we should do, a lot of it we shouldn't, we have disagreements, but I think it's all extremely marginal. I think in terms of really changing the game, in terms of job creation, big numbers, reaching the people that Marty said have been left out because of their skill levels, you're going to have to do a deep dive into infrastructure. You're also going to have to worry a lot more about the trade deficit, and you're probably going to have to engage in some sort of scaled-up, subsidized apprenticeship, employment-on-the-job training program. That, to me, is kind of getting more directly at the problem than some of the kind of blockages you've identified.
Depending on the size of the things that you're discussing, I think there is scope for some, for thinking about apprenticeships. I think it's an example of the kind of rethinking of post-secondary education that I mentioned in my introductory remarks. Right now we kind of ship people off to college or to community colleges, that's kind of it. And I think we need to add a third category where people get the kinds of skills that businesses are looking for. And I think that there's a role for government in helping people to afford that and helping to facilitate information sharing. I think where we may disagree is on how involved government should be there. Something that concerns me with, say, an apprenticeship program, and I'd be curious about your response to this. If the government starts funding these apprenticeship programs, the result in my mind could end up looking very similar to what's happened with healthcare or education, where government is really increasing costs by artificially increasing demand and kind of leaves behind a mess, where there didn't have to be one.
You know what? I want to redirect things here. I'm looking at the clock, but I'm going to, with your permission, we'll go over the half hour mark. But I want to, I think we've covered that to enough of an extent that we can within the confines of this debate. There is, I'm trying to look for, assumptions that are being made in this debate that maybe deserve exploration and not just implicit assumption. There was agreement on both of your parts that it would be wise to redistribute government spending from that aimed to the rich or even the middle class, which is the mortgage interest deduction or state and local tax deduction given to the poor. Laying out the counter argument there is the notion is that there's far greater ripple effect of a dollar kept in the middle class person's pocket. He or she is more likely to spend it on education, create jobs, invest it, Whereas the poor person is going to, yes, either pay for basics like food, shelter, etc., where there's already a safety net, or perhaps even more often spend it on things that we would think have less ripple effect. So do you guys want to take a brief shot at looking at the true wisdom of whether we really are wiser to redistribute more resources from the, quote, the top half to the bottom 20%, say?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's actually not the case that too many of the tax expenditures that Michael and I were citing reach the middle class very much. I think this number is, if not correct, then close to it. About 80% of the benefits of the mortgage interest deduction go to households in the top 20%. Now, this is precisely the kind of wasteful spending that people complain about. That is, the folks up there will make the investments in the house or the boat or whatever it is you're giving a tax credit for without the tax credit. So the tax credit is just a little icing on a cake that they don't need. And given that we're so resource constrained, that just seems, I think, to both Michael and I, to be a wasteful thing. And if you've got a much bigger bang for the buck, in the spirit of the way you framed the question, Marty, then you ought to devote that to the kinds of programs we're talking about. By the way, I thought that the idea of instead of allowing the wealthiest households to take a full a credit for these tax expenditures at their top rate, cut it to 28%, which is in the budget, and they still get something, but it's more efficient.
Michael, any comment?
My understanding is the same as Jared's, that the overwhelming majority of the mortgage interest deduction goes to the top 20% and not to the middle. I think that redistributing some of that down makes a lot of sense, like I said. I would also like to, use some of it to lower marginal rates, and that may be a place where Jared and I disagree. I think, in general, that a tax code with less exemptions and deductions and lower rates is preferable to the one that we currently have. So, I wouldn't want it to push all of it down. I'd want to instead say, okay, what do we actually need down there? What do we need in the bottom 20%? What do we need to help low-income people get into the labor force and be able to, afford the things we want them to afford? And, we have a very wealthy country, and we want to make sure that...
I mean, just to be very concrete, I think we both agreed on an expansion of the earned income tax credit or wage subsidy for low-wage workers. And the one that's on the table, and I think there's been some bipartisan support for this, would cost $60 billion over 10 years. That's actually, you'd easily get multiples of that amount if you just reduce the tax expenditures at the top of the scale. Look, on marginal rates, I probably am speak economies just for a second here. I think the elasticity, the response that you'd get in terms of job creation from tweaking marginal tax rates is small, and probably I think it's smaller than Michael does. Where I think that we need to reform our tax code and lower the top marginal rate would be on the corporate side, not because corporations pay too much. In fact, there's so much tax avoidance in that sector that we're actually hemorrhaging tax revenue in the corporate sector. They're paying less than they have in decades, but that would be a good place to do some base broadening rate lowering.
Yeah, so I would lower the corporate top rate before I lower the individual top rate for sure. I would also use some of that money to lower payroll taxes.
That's an interesting idea.
How would you make up
the difference?
I was curious what you would think about that.
How would you make up the loss?
How would I make up the loss?
Lost revenue, yeah. On the Social Security trust fund.
With the deductions.
Oh, okay. So you do a transfer from general revenue over to the Social Security.
Okay, I want to move the discussion now. Right. Everybody agrees, both in my introduction and each of you in your statements, both in your opening statements and in this discussion, about the need that we need scale. Jared, used the word scale. It's not going to make a big enough difference. And you're talking about infrastructure as one way, and maybe apprenticeship programs to build. I want to try to take a shot here. Now I am going to inject myself. I'm going to take 2 minutes. And I am going to present what I think is it incorporates a few of your ideas and goes well beyond to create job creation that would be of the kind of scale that is, let's just use the word exciting, large and exciting. And I'll use that to trigger, and then I'll try to again shut up and let the two of you guys go back and forth on the wisdom of that overall package rather than, I'm not going to present an atomistic thing. I'm going to present a three-plank plan for creating lots of jobs. Okay, first of all, Michael, you mentioned education and the unbelievable constraints that are placed on educational innovation, not just MOOCs, those massive online courses, but in general, the accreditation. I'm familiar with the California Education Code. It is books after a real constraint, much more about accountability than education. What I would do is I would have a reinvention of K-20 curriculum. K-20, that's all the way through graduate school. Two of the linchpins would be the following. Number one, when we think about courses that we have taken, like take algebra or chemistry, the hard ones, they are rarely transformative, wonderful courses. We say, oh, I've made algebra part of my life. It's hard. But there are in the United States of America, or in the world certainly, there are a few amazingly transformational teachers who can take rich and poor, high IQ and low IQ kids, and really make algebra meaningful. We can only get every kid in the nation to get those kind of classes if we do it online. And so the government would assemble a few of these transformational algebra teachers, create and pair them with people from gamifying places like Lucasfilms and Electronic Arts and whatever, create the ultimate online interactive course where the teacher in the classroom, because we're not going to try to fight the teachers union who would be afraid of losing jobs, would use that either as the main centerpiece of their educational program or use it as homework. That, especially with a course throughout K-20 in entrepreneurship. Because we all know, even on the left or the right, we know that permanent job creation comes from ethical but efficacious new businesses. So creating an army, a new generation of Americans that are ethical entrepreneurs using that kind of dream team taught classes online so that every kid from Maine to San Diego, rich and poor, gets that world-class instruction is likely to create an army of ethical entrepreneurs that will create jobs. That's plank one. Plank two is what I call the assistance army. Many of us would be very wise, even if we are relatively economically strapped, to hire somebody on at least part-time basis to assist us through the lifespan, whether it be helping when we are a parent of a newborn to help with the child, whether it be a homework assistant for their child, a personal assistant to handle our daily crap so that we can go and do more important things, teach us technology, take care of our elder parents. But most people, except for the rich, don't think about having an assistant. We need a massive PR campaign funded both by the government and private sector to encourage people to hire assistants. It's totally pro-social. It creates jobs that are rewarding, that collectively, not maybe a single one, would collectively, if you do two or three of those, at least make a good sideline living and would add a lot of jobs. And finally, three, something that you guys did mention, which is apprenticeships. I am not as worried as Michael about it turning into a blob. We see what enormous benefits a really serious, high-quality apprenticeship program for those who are not going to do as well in college as we would, you know, like we want to say, we say we celebrate diversity, but we don't say diversity in terms of learning styles or learning abilities. We say one size fits all, everyone to college. We should have a high quality apprenticeship program like that of Germany, Finland, England, the best of what, and Japan, take the best of what that is so that there is a high quality, not dumping ground opportunity for people to learn not offshoreable skills, and that's what apprenticeships are, because we have an oversupply of bachelor's degrees, even PhDs, and heaven forbid economics. We have an undersupply of truly high-skilled craftspeople in the trades. Those are unoffshoreable jobs. That's my three-part plank. One, change education so that it uses dream team taught class, especially around entrepreneurship. Two, the assistance army. And three, a high-quality system of apprenticeships. Your reaction, guys.
Michael, you want to go first?
Sure. I'm not wild about plank one. I think that may be where we end up going, especially for post-secondary education. But I'm not wild about the idea of the government pushing us there before society does it on its own, because I think that's the kind of thing that could end up not working very well if it's you know, technocratically managed out of D.C. But I do think that it's a good example of something government should do, which is providing the conditions for folks to make their own choices and flourish, and that is providing the infrastructure for internet access. You know, so if the government can make sure that the infrastructure for internet access is available in a lot of these low-income communities, then if somebody wants to, you know, start teaching an awesome algebra class or something, and people want to pay for it, then, you know, the market can work and can select who does that, and it can, you know, rise or fall on its own merits. So I think there is a part of that, I think, is a really good idea. I think there's a role for government there to allow markets to reach places where they currently aren't. Plank number two, I certainly would like a personal assistant. I try very hard not to use my assistant at AEI as a personal assistant, but I don't know that we, you know, really want the government telling people, hey, you know, you should be personal assistants, or hey, people, you should hire personal assistants. And three, with apprenticeships, you know, I think I need to read more about it, but I'm cautiously in favor of apprenticeships, provided that they're targeted to people who actually need them. You know, I think Jared's right about things like the mortgage interest deduction, where, you know, all you're doing is taking someone who's going to buy a house anyway and, you know, having them buy a slightly bigger house or something. You know, and I think that's the kind of thing that could happen if we start funding apprenticeships for people who are in the middle class and people who are rich. So, you know, there is, you know, I would hate for someone to have to for a low-income American to have to choose between a minimum wage job and an unpaid apprenticeship at a good tech company and take the minimum wage job because they need money. So if the government were to say, hey, you know, we'll pay you, you know, $9 an hour to take that unpaid apprenticeship at that tech company so you don't have to work at McDonald's, that's the kind of thing that I think I could get behind. But an apprenticeship program that applies to, you know, everybody in the country, I think is the kind of thing that could end up not working out nearly as well as people think.
So I think one in three are interesting and deserving of a closer look. Two, I don't. It just sounds weird and whimsical. So and kind of like you know, the make work sort of ideas. I mean, Keynes said if we don't have enough demand, we should just pay one group of people to bury a bunch of money and another group to dig it up. So I'm not sure about two. Number one, I think where Michael went with that was very interesting, the idea of, even if you don't like the idea, which I don't know enough about the MOOC endeavor to say anything too smart about it, but even if you don't like the idea, national infrastructure to increase internet access strikes me as a great thing to do, and it is puzzling to me that you still have difficulty accessing wireless or a good internet connection in many parts of this country, where when in education it's a huge and critical factor now. I think on number three, on apprenticeships, I think it's important to realize about the scope that we're talking. We're being a little too broad here. The scope of apprenticeships that could really work, as I understand it, is not driven by this idea of let's sort of sprinkle money down on apprenticeships. It's driven by the idea of where there are unmet pockets of demand. There's a fairly consistent finding, which is that some of our trades, some of our more skilled trades, particularly in higher-end manufacturing, are actually suffering from inadequate access of a supply of workers who want to or know how to or can do that sort of thing. So the apprenticeship program is targeted in such a way, not to specific firms, we're not picking winners, but to industries where it could really make a positive difference. So I like one in three, and I think two is a little goofy. And let me just say, as an asterisk, none of that sounds very libertarian, Marty, so I don't know what happened to you over the years that we haven't spoken. You're talking about pretty significant government expenditures here, I would guess.
Absolutely. No, I'm not a pure, you know, I have libertarian, I have a, I think I do have a healthy disrespect of about the inefficiency of government, but I'm not saying the answers always lie in the private sector. I like to think there are solutions that come
I really appreciate the thought that you're putting into this. I like the creativity.
Well, I try. Anyway, let's turn back to you guys. Now it's, for the listeners, by the way, who are just joining us, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We are having one of our debates, our friendly debates. Again, I don't like those debates that sometimes either are straw men that I've seen, frankly, on CNN, but they put on a real weak conservative and a really strong liberal, and they make it look like they're trying to be fair. Right, exactly. It is a debate between two people who like each other, know each other, recommended each other, at least Jared recommended his opponent, on the core question, but who are very different. One, you know, Jared is from the left and was President Biden's chief economic advisor, and Michael Strain works at the American Enterprise Institute as a resident scholar. But we're debating the core question that undergirds the show, which is, how the hell do we create more jobs in America in a serious, significant way beyond the bumper sticker soundbite that politicians provide? And so we're now at the closing statements part. So I invite each of you to take a moment to think about, you know, not a recapitulation of necessarily of what you said in your opening statement. We've had a very rich discussion over these 45 minutes, and I'd encourage you to make a closing statement that will leave you and perhaps our listeners satisfied, coming with a capstone that's going to make them feel like, okay, this approach that's generally from, in your case, Jared, on the left, is one that makes more sense while acknowledging Michael's points on the right, and then vice versa, having Michael do the same thing. And so in this case, because Jared first made the opening statements, Michael, would you please, on the right, from the American Enterprise Institute, go first. You've got about 90 seconds to make your closing statement.
First of all, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it, and thanks, Jared. It's always fun to engage with you and productive. You wanted the closing statement to kind of capture what was discussed in the debate and to reflect some evolution. Mm-hmm. Jared's comment that some of the things that I said were marginal made me think of two things that aren't, and so I'm going to use my closing statement for those. If you think about how economies grow and create jobs, and you're measuring it in centuries, it's through innovation and through ideas. If you're measuring it in years, it's through savings and investment. So two big, massive things that we could do in order to create good jobs and keep the economy growing would be to switch to a system of consumption taxation. Right now we tax income, we tax savings. Those are two things that we like. If you tax something, you get less of it. We're getting less income and less savings than we would. If we were to move to a consumption taxation, estimates suggest that could grow the size of the economy quite considerably over a period of time. And the second thing, more incentives for innovation. We need to be creating entrepreneurs. We need to be providing existing companies with more incentives to innovate. That means totally rethinking the way we do immigration policy. It means totally rethinking the way that we treat business investment and research and development. It means totally rethinking the way that we provide education to people, particularly past the eighth grade. So those are two things to leave with your listeners to think about that are very grand in scope.
Michael Strain, thank you very much. Now, Jared Bernstein, your 90-second closing statement.
Very, very interesting. I enjoyed the debate and listening to Michael. It's funny. I feel like we could almost do a bit of a flip here when it comes to the conservative and the liberal view of government. When it comes to innovation, which I agree is absolutely critical and you know quite missing from the U.S. economy for over a decade now in a really important way, I actually don't think government has all that much to do with it. I do think we should continue to fund the kind of research and development that's always been core. If you look at some of the key innovators over the years, the Internet is one. I mean, Al Gore may not have invented it, but it came out of DARPA, which is a defense industry. So I'm not saying there isn't a role for government there, but I don't think it really will fix what's ailing us because I think that has to just bubble up out of the private sector. I think what's really ailing, really hurting us in terms of job growth is a word that maybe hasn't been mentioned enough in this debate, and that's demand. There's just not enough demand in this economy, not enough demand for labor. And demand for labor, Econ 101, is derived from demand for goods, demand for services, demand for investments. Now, you know, Michael suggested we need to do more investment, and I don't disagree, but we have massive and extremely cheap stocks of loanable funds sitting on the sidelines waiting to come into the economy. But what's missing? Demand. So we have to create more demand, and I think we have to do that the more directly that we do it, the better. I think a deep dive into repairing our stock of public goods through an infrastructure investment speaks precisely to every angle of what's needed. It creates more demand for labor, and it creates a more productive society, and it injects considerable investment into the economy. So I think that that's a great way to go. We didn't talk enough about lowering the trade deficit, but if we want to help our manufacturers, that's something we could and should do. And there are important ways to go about that, mostly by pushing back on competitors who manage their currencies to get an advantage over us. So, and finally, look, if the market isn't going to create the demand that we need, it's not going to create the labor demand, the jobs, then we have a responsibility to do so through the public sector. Doesn't mean we have to send a bunch of guys out in the woods to build a dam like they did in the New Deal, but subsidizing employment for folks who are left out of the fringes of the labor market through apprenticeships, on-the-job training programs, and pure subsidized employment would help as well. To me, those are the kinds of ideas that will create the demand we need to get employment going up again.
Well, both of you, Jared Bernstein and Michael Strain, it was truly a pleasure. I mean, it is kind of shows like this that make me so privileged to have this airtime, and you guys were as richly deserving of airtime as anybody I could think of, and I really appreciate both of you joining us. I want to give you, you know, you guys have written a ton of stuff. Jared Bernstein, if you want people to read, you know, either a particular article or that you would like them to Google and read that you've written, or even simply to your website, what's a URL?
Everything I write, I create a link to my website, which is jaredbernsteinblog.com. So go there and you'll find links to everything elucidating.
Great. Jared Bernstein, Jared is J-A-R-E-D, Bernstein the usual way it's spelled, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, blog.com.
Correct.
And Michael Strain, where would you like to send people to read your stuff?
He would like to send them to Jared Bernstein.
I go to Jared Bernstein blog myself all the time, every day. You can just Google Michael Strain, A-E-I, Strain is S-T-R-A-I-N.
Right. Well, again, thank you very much both for giving me part of your Sunday and giving our listeners.
All right. Goodbye, guys.
Right. Be well, both of you. Okay. Take care. Okay. We have a few minutes left. I always like to, whatever time I have left, rather than focusing on any more of this discussion or this debate. It was supposed to be a half hour. We took 52 minutes because these guys were wonderful. But if you have a personal problem, that's the macro. We do shows, you know, we focus on both the macro, that's the societal improvement around work, but also we care about you as individuals. So if you have a problem, you're struggling in your work life, or you have a success story you'd like to share, but anything related to work, we do what are called workovers here. Without further ado, I'm just going to give out the phone number. If you need some career help, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We only do have a couple of minutes, so I want to encourage you to get on that phone now if you'd like some free help. Okay. While we're waiting for calls to come, if they do come in, I'm going to do this. I promised last week that I was going to devote some of the show to a new model for reducing procrastination, and I guess, you know, we have calls coming in, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the world. You know what, I haven't forgotten about you, dear listeners, who are caring about my current best shot at reducing procrastination, because I have, that's one of the main things I deal with my clients, and I've developed a model I think is effective. I will get to it hopefully, you know, next week, or if this call is short, I'll do it later now. Anyway, but let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, I was wondering, I love your show.
Thank you.
I was wondering what you thought was, as a young person, sort of growing up a few years out of college for someone who's, you know, very, for the huge number of people that I know who are very overqualified mm-hmm. for the work that they're doing, who are very passionate and very driven, mm-hmm. and who really want to work to do something ideally, they always say, oh, well, you want to have a company with a good corporate social responsibility to attract the millennials. But really, I think what I'm trying to say is, quote-unquote, millennials want a lot more than that. They really want to do something that they think is, like, genuinely going to make a huge impact. So, like, the dream job might not even be the internship at Google or something like that. It would be, like, working for a solar panel company.
Right.
And so I guess what I'm... But I feel like, you know, especially talking about demand and the lack of demand, I think there's actually a lack of supply in the sense of these kinds of jobs. And I guess I'm wondering what jobs you would recommend these kinds of very talented, out-of-college, super-driven, very smart kids who want to do something for the environment as their work that's also respectable and they could, like, raise a family on. Like, what do you think, like, you'd recommend to people in that situation?
Great question. Okay. What I would recommend is they go to conferences. You came back to the sun, you said the environment, you said solar. If it were me and I was a young, again, this is specifically to the targeted group of people you're talking about. You said really smart, overqualified, driven, want to make a difference in the as defined by solar and the whole alternative energy space for now. I would be going, the man is going to screw you. The employer is going to pay you as little as they can, and they're going to squash you. Somebody who is really overqualified, driven, they're going to pay you crap, and they're going to give you, you know, they're going to give you jobs that are not going to give you the kind of autonomy and drive. I do think that entrepreneurship is the most important topic that is not taught at Stanford and Berkeley, your typical student, but rather you should go to these conferences with your antenna out, go to the exhibit areas, talk to the people and look for their pain point. It was Henry Kaiser, the founder of the Kaiser Foundation, who said the key to finding good work is find the problem and fix it. I invite you to go to conference after conference. Don't talk to the attendees. You can talk to the attendees if you want, sure. But go and go to exhibit area after exhibit area. They don't just have bimbos standing there holding balloons. What they have very often are the leaders of those organizations there because those leaders want to take the pulse of the attendees. So you're going to get access to large numbers of people who are truly in the belly of this beast and try to understand their pain points. What is keeping you up at night? What are the problems that are unmet needs? Where are the bottlenecks? Asking those questions, using all that drive and intelligence to find out what's missing. And then, because it's very hard to start a one-person business, if you sound like you're part of this network of really smart, really driven, really, let's just say, progressively idealistic people, when you should form a group that meets once a week and you share the ideas that you've gotten, that you've gleaned from all of that, and then decide which one of those ideas is worth trying a startup. Whether it fails or not, starting, you will learn so much from trying to create one of those businesses that's not dealing with the consumer. Solar panels are a commodity. They're imported from China. There's no money there. But there are business-to-business bottlenecks and pain that a group of small, driven, smart, idealistic people could address. And that is my best advice, if you are my son or daughter, as to how to go about making money and making a difference. Does that make sense? He's gone. Wow, he must have... I thought he wouldn't like my idea. Maybe he hated it or he just got disconnected or whatever, but that's the way it goes. Hopefully he heard it. In any case, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and for that last-minute caller. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers and... Where is the hiring? What job titles? What does it really take to get hired? What are they paying? What percentage of jobs are temp these days? How likely is a job to go from temp to perm? I'll talk with Mark Daugherty. He is division director for the well-known recruiter, Robert Half. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.